Hey, citizens of the internet, welcome to another work from home episode of Long Shots. And I have with me Sharad Tupran on the line. Hey, Sharad, how's it going, man?
It's going very good. I think this is the new normal now. I've been homebound in lockdown for well over 3 weeks now. So this is the new normal.
Yeah, I think we should start posting our selfies to, you know, kind of see the progression or degradation of facial as well as head hair.
Yeah. That'll be amusing viewing.
Yeah, for sure. Today is, again, very, very happy to have with us an exciting guest. We have with us Professor Shashwat Alok, Assistant Professor of Finance from the Indian School of Business. Hey, Shashwat, how's it going?
Hey, Nikhil. Going as good as can in current situations. All of us are adjusting to the new normal.
Yes, absolutely. But still, it's, Sharad, I'm beginning to realize that these podcasts, you know, aside from the thing that we do, has become a good excuse to just catch up, you know, kind of bypass the social distancing thing.
I know. And people are much more articulate when you give them a mic around. So the quality of conversations also have been elevated, right?
Yeah. So we just like, you know, we kind of just align it with our day-to-day work routine. So one doesn't feel guilty about just, you know, chatting.
Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
So Shashwat, we are going to talk about a lot of things. Just to give a sense, obviously, about your background. Shashwat has many areas of expertise within the domain of finance, but he primarily looks at, financial intermediation, managerial compensation, corporate governance, corporate investments. These, Shashwat, obviously, are things I've picked up from your comprehensive profiles on LinkedIn and the ISB website. If there's anything I'm missing, please feel free to add that.
No, I think that covers most of it. I also dabble these days a little bit on climate finance and fintech.
Right. Cool. So plenty of things to talk about. But before we kind of go into corporate governance, obviously we should kind of, you know, face the elephant in the room, COVID-19. Obviously, I'm assuming Shashwat, ISB, like many educational institutions, you guys must be under a lockdown. Things must have changed dramatically in the last couple of weeks. But like stepping aside from there, from a macroeconomic perspective, I'm sure you must be, regularly following what the finance ministry is saying or what the RBI is actually coming up with, in terms of policy actions and also in terms of just the economic fallout. What's your reading of things at a very high level, in the sense that I see the biggest concern from most people within the financial world is around liquidity and is around survivorship.
Right. My view is that RBI, I think, has done a great job. They came up with a package quite early on, proactively during the COVID, and they have revised the package. Now, I think they are doing as much as possible. They are all guns are out.
So today, I guess, there was obviously the announcement on the enhanced TLTRO. There was also some conversation on reduction of the reverse repo in order to incentivize, guys who are tapping in the repo window to actually deploy capital into commercial paper, into NBFCs. So I think that was a good iterative action that was taken, right?
Right. So NBFCs, I think there was some concern about among the industry people that NBFCs were left out of the debt moratorium. They were supposed to extend it to their borrowers, but they were not receiving it from the lenders. So I think some of this liquidity injection will solve those issues.
But I mean, but I guess NBFC still cannot avail the moratorium, correct? I mean,
they can't. Yeah. But at least there is some provision for liquidity.
Right, that's correct. But you know, the approach of the RBI is pretty different from what the Fed has done, right? Like Fed has actually gone for a lot of direct intervention in terms of just buying corporate bonds straight away, whereas RBI is going through the financial system. Do you see any red flags or concerns with that approach, or do you actually think that RBI shouldn't get into the business of direct deployment?
Yeah, so unfortunately, I'm an economist, so I'll have two hands.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually like the way RBI is moving on this. America is supposed to be the paragon of free market economy, and to that extent, letting the markets figure this out on their own is a great idea, as long as you make sure that liquidity provisions are there. But at the same time, we know that all this moves at the macro prudential level is not always transmitted to the borrowers. So from that perspective, RBI can inject as much liquidity as it wants, but until the bank starts extending liquidity or NBFCs, other financial intermediations start extending those rate cuts to their borrowers, you know, we won't have a lot of effect. So ultimately, it lies on whether the transmission is happening or not.
But I mean,
because US Fed is intervening directly, at least for them, they know that the transmission is immediate.
I guess there's a lag effect here, right? I mean, here right now you do a TLTRO, then you have a 1 month window in which you have to deploy it within the eligible instrument, right? So here there is some amount of lag that might naturally creep in as a result.
Right, right, exactly, yeah.
And like Nikhil and I were discussing it in one of our earlier work from home podcasts as well, right? I mean, the focus entirely on the first round was, and quite rightly so, to just de-stress the credit markets, right? Like let the lending keep on going on. I mean, if that dries up, then it sort of has a spillover and cascading effect on everything around it, right? I mean, the focus was for the markets to figure it out, but de-stress it so that the supply chain of lending markets keep on going, right? I mean, that prevents liquidity from tying up.
Right, right, yeah. And we know that our banking system is already quite stressed even before COVID, so...
Yeah, that's a very interesting discussion as well that, you know, again, we had last week, I guess, right? We were not completely healthy from a credit and lending standpoint as it is,
right.
And then the pandemic came, so there's a little bit of noise there, right, on what's causing. As it is, we were struggling, and you know, Yes Bank was making a lot of noise, and we were seeing a lot of bad debt coming into the system. So this sort of elevates it and accelerates that problem, right?
Exactly. So I am actually a little bit concerned about this. So people are talking about the health system being potentially stressed.
Yeah.
I think we need to equally be concerned about the financial system and bankruptcy courts getting increasingly stressed.
Right.
And that can have a ratcheting effect on the economy. So I think RBI so far has done a great job, and I hope that they will come up with more measures as and when needed. And they have been proactive. They have been promising that, don't worry, we'll do whatever is required to put the economy back on trajectory.
Yeah. And Shashwat, you know, talked about sort of the effect of rate cuts or whatever RBI initiatives. It has to flow through to the bottom line or flow through to the end user, so as to speak, to get the economic engines running, right? What is the missing piece there? Is it corporate governance? Is it just more on the regulation standpoint? Is there, you know, not enough checks and balances which are there? Like, what, I mean, I'm slowly, we are segueing into your area of expertise as well, but what do you think? And Nikhil as well, like you, Nikhil, the questions for you as well, like seeing from a investment banking standpoint and with a FIG exposure, like how do you make that happen? Because the textbook will teach you, you know, you cut rates and it gets transferred and the economy, you know, people borrow more and the economic activity picks up, but that's what the textbook says. And real life generally a lot of times does not exactly mimic like that, right? So how do you tackle such a thing?
I think, I mean, you know, it's very fascinating the way you have put it. And it, probably these things can be driven both by macro as well as micro factors. So obviously right now, thanks to the pandemic, we're all talking about the macro factors, right? But when you look at things on an organization-wise level, it's not like there were not issues already embedded there. So, I mean, if you look at like free markets, if you look at generally, you know, information symmetry, I mean, there are some rules of the game which have to be in place before we can go on, you know, extrapolating what exactly is happening. For instance, if suppose a company kind of comes up with a disclosure or a bank says, you know, X is the quantity of non-performing loans I have, you have to believe that number, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if those numbers, the way those numbers have been collated, or the internal management processes which are in place, if they are flawed, no matter what, you know, the RBI or broader macro institutions are going to do, I mean, things don't really pan out well. And there is an additional, I think, side effect that comes out, that some of these institutions which have these governance gaps, they are so big to fail now that you end up rescuing that in spite of the fact that there were governance lapses in the first place. So, I mean, kind of it's an excellent segue to kind of, you know, what Shashwat looks at pretty closely. And Shashwat, like, you know, like if you look at like, let's not even look at the broader corporate side. Let's look at just banks and, you know, major financial institutions. We had ICICI, we had DHFL, we had ILNFS, now we have Yes Bank. There's a common thread between all of them, right? When it comes to conflict of interest, when it comes to, you know, misreporting, And I'm sure that the Indian Companies Act is, you know, full of rules to put a check on these things. I mean, I don't think there is a deficiency when it comes to the legal framework. So what exactly are we missing? You know, because, you know, we keep on reading, you know, you have to have X many independent directors. You have to have X many auditors. There's so much paperwork, so much compliance load on companies in general. And even in spite of that, such kind of governance lapses are regularly creeping in, especially within the financial system. So what's your read of that?
So, you ask a lot of questions, I'll get through to them in a little bit detail. Let me just connect you to what you were talking about, monetary policy transmission, corporate governance within banks. What's the question that Sharath raised? So there is an interesting paper by Prachi Mishra, who was earlier a research director at RBI, Professor Prabhala, who is a professor of finance at Maryland, University of Maryland, and Abhiman Das, who is currently a researcher at RBI. So they look at exactly this question. Who responds most to the monetary policies? Who responds fast? And which kind of banks are sluggish in their responses? And not surprisingly, they find that within banks also, the branches which are larger, which have lower liability ratios and are more profitable, ex ante, are the ones that would respond most immediately to a monetary policy change. Surprisingly, what they find is that state-owned banks are generally the most sluggish in responding to monetary policy. One would have assumed that because state-owned banks are under the control of the government, they should pass on the rate cuts sooner than later, but that doesn't seem to be the case. And to some extent, it has to do with managerial capacity and the internal, not really corporate governance, but internal governance of firms. So they find that internal friction more than external frictions are what drives the lack of policy transmission.
That's fascinating. That is counterintuitive for me. I know people generally expect better information flow and better managerial control in a private sector bank, but the sluggishness at which rate cuts are transferred, I would have thought it probably private companies come later than state-owned companies.
Yeah, I would have thought the same. But this is why, data-driven research is important. It gives you insight that you would not expect otherwise.
So bringing it back to what
Nikhil was talking about, the Companies Act 2013, I agree with you that there's a huge compliance cost on firms with respect to complying with the number of changes, right? The auditor, whether you can have an independent board, having a female on the board, the reporting, RPTs, which are related party transactions. So I think the companies that did a great job, you know, in terms of providing a broad vision of what good corporate governance should look like. Almost all of what was missing in the past is now being brought in to the extent that even independent directors, their firing and all, there is some constraint on what promoters can do with independent directors, who can be an independent director, etc., etc. But the problem ultimately lies with execution. We can have the best laws in the world, but ultimately what we need is contract enforcement. And that is where India has been lacking severely, as we know, for a while.
But like when you say execution...
It's an execution problem. But if you look at the broad trends in the past 5-6 years, yes, we've had some unfortunate cases, but the broad trend across companies is of improving corporate governance.
Right. I mean, you know, when you kind of alluded to execution, is it in terms of lack of monitoring from the regulatory authorities, or is it a question of just the so-called, you know, I would say criminal justice system or civil justice system? The fact that, if S hits the fan, there are no consequences for a certain set of people, or there are low consequences for a certain set of people. I know things are changing. I agree with you there. I know that, you know, for the first time in contemporary history, a lot of the Indian promoters are actually a bit wary and a bit concerned that you just cannot do stuff and get away with it. But still, one does see major lapses happening. Why do you think the execution gap is there where it is?
So, I mean, yes, regulatory oversight is so far in India not that great. But I am personally not too concerned about it because there is only so much that a regulatory body can do. And in general, I am more of a free market guy, so I don't like a lot of regulatory intervention. But in India, it's needed. I get that. I think part of the reason is ultimately it goes back to conflict of interest and intent, right? This has been the corporate culture in India for ages now. So firms have to adjust to new ways of doing business, and so do regulators.
Yeah. So and it's evolving rapidly as well, right?
It's evolving rapidly. I mean, it needs to evolve at a, I think, at a much faster pace. So yes. So when you talked about this judiciary or the clogged up civil court system, that I think does add to it. Like ultimately, if you think about, let's think of a simple framework. We have a promoter who owns the majority share in the firm. The promoter has definitely incentive to act in his or her own interest and extract rent for their personal gains at the cost of minority shareholders.
Yeah.
Now, what would prevent the promoter from doing this? So, the expected cost of the corporate governance failure, right, or the regulatory action that comes in. What the Companies Act or any regulatory policy does is it envisions the cost imposed on you if you are detected and let's say convicted, and bank firms are not being convicted, but for the lack of a better word, let's call them that they are convicted, they're detected for fraud. Conditional on being detected, there is a huge cost on the firm.
Right.
But the expected cost depends upon not just the what happens after detection, but the probability of being detected. And the probability of being detected and convicted lies ultimately with the judiciary. And it's not that they are not doing their best. They are doing their best within the limited capacity, but we need to increase capacity at a rampant pace. And until that happens, the expected probability of getting caught goes up. If the probability of getting caught is zero, no matter what the cost is, the expected cost is going to be zero.
But Shashwat, like, if we take a step back and like look at something very fundamental about Indian companies, majority businesses here are family held, right? Majority businesses here, you know, have a fair bit of entrenchment in terms of, you know, the most basic agent, principal agent problem, correct? So, if you compare it to like a Western setup, I mean, when I say Western setup, I mean mostly Western Europe or US. Obviously, when you look at like Eastern Europe or Southern Europe or Southeast Asia, it has a lot of similarities with the Indian, I would say, holding structure, right? But in those jurisdictions, you see, the free float of companies when they are listed on the stock market are much bigger. The average shareholding is much smaller. It's widely held kind of a structure. There is a lot of self-regulation, you know, rather than actually government regulatory bodies looking at everything. The industry tends to regulate itself. Is that the direction that we should be taking in the long term? So that, you know, there is a natural check and balance which comes from a widely held shareholding as well as a self-regulated framework.
Yeah, so that's a great question. So unfortunately, I'm an academic, so I'll bore you with a little bit of details. You know, I think from the perspective of going back to the roots, the fundamentals. So what mechanisms do firms or industries have or shareholders have to deal with corporate governance failure? Right? It starts with executive compensation. You can always design incentive contracts such that they have incentive to create as much shareholder value as possible. You also have a board of directors who are supposed to, again, act in the best interest of shareholders. Then in countries like that, you mentioned US, UK, you have widely dispersed ownership. So somebody with a 5% stake is also can potentially be the controlling stakeholder.
Right.
In India, the ownership is very, very concentrated and is usually driven by family or promoters. And that seems to be the biggest risk that one faces. There is extensive literature and evidence on this, that promoter risk is a big risk in terms of corporate governance failures. And there is a discount. Markets expect such corporate governance failures to happen ex ante. Obviously, they don't know the probability with which it will happen, but there is some expectation that there is a discount attached with firms with lower quality of corporate governance and this promoter risk. But at the end of the day, these are all institutional features that one can play around with. Ultimately, market forces and industries can be self-regulating.
Yeah.
And the way they self-regulate is if I'll give you some anecdotal examples. Right? When Rana Kapoor's continuance was disapproved by RBI,
right,
on that day itself, there was a 29% drop in stock price. You see the same for Tata when Mistry was fired and Infosys when Vishal Sikka was fired.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So when markets see the corporate governance failure, there is an immediate reaction happening. So to the extent that we can ensure an environment in which shareholders get timely information, right? Disclosure is lacking. If we could ensure good quality disclosure, then we don't even need a regulatory body. The markets will figure this out on their own. They will punish bad firms by lowering the stock price. They will reward good firms by buying the stocks at higher prices. What you need for that is a good information environment. And many Asian economies lack that part. Disclosure is not great.
Yeah, and to your sort of point about concentrated ownership, right? Like, I think in sort of our index in the Nifty, I think the average free float market capitalization is about 50%. And you compare that with mid-90s for S&P 500 or FTSE and the other leading indices, right? But when you have such high concentrated ownership, even the movement of stocks are volatile, right? I mean, that's how the math works. So even those swings, there's a double effect that you see a heightened volatility on either direction, one way or the other. That itself is a deterrent for a lot of institutional investors, right? That also is a big factor, correct?
Right, yeah, yes. So for some, so you've gotten the point of institutional investors, and that is another instrument for corporate governance, right? Institutional investors are typically larger shareholders.
Yeah.
And they have incentives to monitor the firm. Mm. Unfortunately, it turns out that while in US, institutional ownership is linked with positive stock market return in future better governance practices, in India, the correlation is zero. So institutional ownership by Indian institutions doesn't translate into better corporate governance. They don't act like activist investors. It doesn't lead to future profitable returns.
Yeah, yeah.
At the same time, foreign institutional investors, when they invest in Indian firms, you see an immediate stock price reaction. Yeah. So when a foreign bank or a foreign mutual fund picks up stake in an Indian firm, the markets now anticipate that, you know, corporate governance is going to improve in this firm. And so you see a positive reaction. Our institutional setup is not there yet. It's gradually getting in that direction. We don't even have proxy advisors.
I mean, this is super interesting because, I mean, I guess there are two things here happening, right? When a foreign institutional investor takes a stock. One is obviously there is that expectation that corporate governance may improve. The second is there's also a strong signaling effect, right? That means that
these guys
are actually better than the rest. That's why these guys are actually going into it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yes.
And but I mean, in terms of FIIs, the on the flip side, the problem is that they are flaky at the end of the day, right? I mean,
yes, I agree. Well, I mean, on the bright side, the banks, so when firms in India issue large debts, again, I mean, we have a lot of bad debts on banks' balance sheet. On an average, markets do seem to think that banks are associated with better monitoring. So when a firm issues a large debt, there's typically a positive stock price reaction, even in India as well.
Right.
And banks are also associated with some improvement in corporate governance practices within India as well. So when I talked about institutional investors, I'm leaving bank out of that broad term.
Right. Yeah.
So there is some positive signals within India as well. And as you rightly pointed out, all of this is also a signaling effect. When a large bank gives a lot of debt to a corporate, at least on paper, and until you're a Punjab National Bank, markets expect that, you know, banks would have done their due diligence and this would be a good quality firm. That is why banks are extending loan. But now we know from anecdotes that that may not always be the case.
Yeah, it's a dangerous assumption now.
Yeah, I know.
But you know, you kind of made the point on the auditors. Now let's talk about auditors now. You know, okay, there are disclosure requirements. There are like quarterly disclosure requirements, I guess. There is probably a major delta between the extent of disclosure one does at an annual level versus a half yearly level as a quarterly level. But okay, let's even leave that aside. When it comes to the auditors themselves, do you think the issue here is that the auditors need to be held more accountable? Or is it because the auditors are kind of dependent on the management, right? In terms of what information is transmitted to them.
Right. So, I mean, this issue applies to both auditors and independent directors, right? It's de facto versus de jure independence.
Right.
At the end of the day, the auditor needs to get business from the same firm over and over again.
Right.
So there is going to be conflict of interest. The same happens with independent director. If I'm appointed a director on a board of a firm, ultimately the CEO or the promoter will decide whether I continue on the board. And there can be flimsy grounds on which I can be fired. And companies act tries to fix that, and there have been various updates, amendments to the act to deal with this specific issue. If you look at Satyam scandal, if you look at Enron scandal, both of these, I don't remember the exact firm, but both of these were being audited by the top three audited firms in the world.
Arthur Anderson, I think. That was for Enron, right? It shut down.
So that is, I think academics have also struggled with this. On an average, independent boards, even on paper, tend to do better job than non-independent boards. But independent itself is suspect. What do you mean by independence?
Right. I mean, at least in the in the largest multinational corporations, right? Be it major financial institutions. Like, I mean, I have been part of one for some time. I'm not saying like HSBC has a clean record of governance by no means. You know, there is that entire concept of like you have KYC for a retail customer. Most of these places typically tend to have some sort of a KYC process for, you know, even for directors, for transactions which you are doing, so that there's that, you know, centralized repository of data which can be looked at. Now, for instance, like, you know, if you have to select an independent director, typically the system has to throw some sort of a red flag into him, you know, if that person is not an appropriate choice. Are we like talking too much into the future, or is that, you think, the way ahead in order to, you know, fix this problem of, you know, who can actually monitor and supervise board level decision making?
So I don't think this is going too much into the future. I think this will definitely help, but again, you have to think, right? So exactly, you can choose the best director possible on paper. Once the director enters the boardroom, then they are susceptible to the same problems, maybe less so than those who are non-independent to begin with. Right. Once you are part of the board, you are part of the club. To remain part of the club, you need to pander to the CEO or the promoter's interest. And that is where the problem ultimately starts, I think. How do we fix that? One possibility is to have at least one third of the directors directly appointed by the shareholders.
Right.
So promoters don't even get to nominate, shareholders nominate, and they directly vote on those directors. And the firing of those directors also ultimately needs to be approved by board, by shareholders. With India, the majority shareholder tends to be promoter, so they can always get their say. Right. So maybe some of them has to be minority shareholder. It has to be specific. That only if you're a minority shareholder, you can nominate one third of these independent directors to the board.
Yeah.
But it's also a question of consequence, right? What's the consequence if you screw up as an independent?
Consequences are huge. Like sometimes you can, I think the reputational costs are huge. So we have an example of from ISB itself. Our ex-dean, Mr. M.R. Rao, was on Satyam board.
Right.
At the time of the scandal broke. So right now, some guidelines say that, you know, you can have independent experts, academics from various institutions in India as part of your board. And on paper, they will look independent. I mean, he's a great guy. I met him personally. There is not a black spot on his CV throughout his career.
Right.
But even the best guys may not be able to control what is going on in the firm for two reasons. One is about the incentive itself. The incentive changes once you become part of the club. Mm-hmm. But second and more importantly, you get to see what the CEO shows you, right? The P&L statement that you see, the balance sheet that you see is what the CEO is showing you. And if they are themselves not audited properly or manipulated, then what do you do?
Yeah, and that is just fraud, right? I mean, like, we're trying to assess the checks and balances that need to be put in for fraud. Showing incorrect numbers is more for me like, what are the consequences of it? Right. I mean,
like, so, but you know, just to kind of get it, like, you feel that it's a case of information asymmetry or wrong information being presented rather than a case of malintent in many situations.
In many situations, yes. I mean, not in all, but in many situations, I do feel that a lot of independent boards want to act in the best interest of shareholders.
Right.
But there is significant information asymmetry. So, Mr. M.R. Rao, Dr. M.R. Rao did face a huge reputational cost. You know, he had to resign from the dean positions at ISB.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, he's an academic and he cares about his prestige and reputation for sure. He had a huge fallout in his career. So there are huge costs being faced by people when a scandal breaks out.
Right.
But despite that, of course, until you have the information, this is the one. What can you do?
Because, you know, like, then it kind of quickly goes in a circle, right? Because, I mean, like, independent directors are kind of essential to ensure that, you know, the disclosures and the audit happens as per due process. But the selection of the independent directors itself is driven by majority shareholders / promoters.
Right, at least, if not on paper, then at least.
And even if suppose they are selected in the right way, then a lot of the information that comes to the directors comes through internal business channels. So, I mean, like, you see what I'm kind of getting at. Like, where exactly, how do you break that circularity?
Maybe elevated whistleblower protection, right? I mean, That's something that people have been talking about a lot as well, that one way is to protect whistleblowers in whatever shape and form you can. And the second, like you talk about self-regulation that happens, like I also feel like market participants have a huge say in shorting or driving the direction of the company, which eventually does affect minority and majority shareholders.
Right.
So there is that effect as well, right? I mean, but whistleblower protection, what do you think about that as a important tool in self-governing?
So whistleblower protection has already been brought in by the government as far as I think, that is a great move. Ultimately, what Nikhil was saying earlier as well, we see some trend towards promoters, you know, getting punished.
Yeah.
That itself, I think, is a huge deterrent. You don't even have to punish everybody. If 10 people are caught and punished and jailed, that creates
absolutely
a huge deterrent going forward, right? It's a change of corporate culture, change of mindset that has to begin, and that has to begin with a deterrent.
You know, I mean, I was just thinking, like...
As detection goes up, punishment goes up, the disclosure will automatically improve. But I think the focus should be on disclosure and good and verifiable, high-quality information.
I mean, you know, it's. I was just thinking, like, for instance, I mean, I'm not saying US is the perfect case study, but US is one of those geographies where white-collar crime is taken very, very seriously, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you actually have cases like Bernie Madoff, who was sent to, like, prison for 150 years. I don't know whatever the number is. But,
yeah.
I mean, in India, I think it's for the first time that you're actually even discussing the possibility of a promoter actually going to prison. And you're right, if a few of them do, then it kind of gives a shock to the system, right? Okay, that no one here is a holy cow. I know that's not controversial to probably say in current times, but that I think message is also quite essential.
Yeah, completely agree. I think that is the message that the government regulators need to be sending. I mean, if you look at SEC, for instance, they hire from the best PhD program in the US, they have invested a lot in capacity building.
Right.
SEBI is headed in the direction, but at a rate which is slower than what I would personally like.
Right.
So I don't think we have enough regulatory capacity within India as well to deal with white collar crime. Maybe because we never cared about them, we never thought that they were crimes. And now there is gradual move towards that. I hope that things will only improve with time. So and SEC always have this, you know, revolving faculty coming from top institutions around the world to work with them on many of these issues. And so they have industry experts coming and working with them. They have built a team of, you know, people who are data scientists, researchers in economics, finance, macroeconomics, and then we need some sort of state capacity buildup of that level in India as well, and you'll see things improving.
Yeah, and in addition to that, like, there's one thing, obviously there's a massive positive signaling effect when someone does goes and serves time, but there has to be a monetary element to it as well. Like, a lot of promoters are happy to sort of collect the paychecks and take that risky position because the downside from a monetary standpoint is asymmetric, right? I mean, you don't give back what you've made through fraud.
I mean, yeah, but to the extent that you can, you do extract, right? I mean, if you look at Vijay Mallya, for instance, you think he didn't have a monetary loss? I think he had a huge monetary loss. I mean, he would probably still live a good life for Nirav Modi, for instance, but the life that they built in India is gone, and that is a huge cost. That should act as a deterrent, at least for some people.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. I agree. But, you know, like, Shashwat, I think there was a time when, you know, when you were having this discussion and you were talking a bit about, you know, identification of firm and auditor clusters, if I recall, who engage in such behavior. How do you think one can go about it?
So I don't know the details, how the government is going about it. What do I know is for sure, they are working on creating a new team of professionals working with the government, the tax authorities, to increase the probability of detection of fraud and tax evasion both. And they are bringing in a bunch of tools, AI, machine learning, network analysis. So one possibility, and this is again a very crude way of thinking about it, but it provides you the basic intuition of what one could do. So Ministry of Corporate Affairs has data on all private firms in India. They need to file their tax statement every year. You also know who the auditor is. If you look at past data, you know, you can look at when tax evasion happened or when a fraud happened, who was the auditor. Many times for small firms, these are independent one-person firms or a couple of person accounting auditing firms. You can then start identifying clusters on how the firms are linked through networks and do the same firms or the same auditors show up again and again in these clusters. Once you identify this cluster of potential transmission of fraud through firms and through this auditor network, then you can start flagging them and randomly checking them. So random check is important because we can't go and start, you know, go after all firms in the industry.
Yeah.
That also creates uncertainty, unnecessary compliance cost on firms that can be more counterproductive than creating value in the long run. But this idea of random checks and using data science, network analysis, etc. to identify such potential clusters and starting to flag them early on, that I think can be a game changer. I know that some of it has already happened with income tax and the shell companies. A lot of them have been identified and closed down. On the income tax part, I'll rather not reveal what is going on here, but a lot of people, a lot of rich businessmen in Delhi who are not filing taxes commensurate with their expenditure, they have been caught. So in the tax, what people also do is they look at, you know, your some measure of your expenses,
mm-hmm.
and right. then they try to correlate with your reported income on the tax filings. You can do the same for firms.
Mm.
How much tax are you paying? How much are you consuming? How much are you producing? And if there is a huge gap between what you report as, or not what you report as expense, but what we can gather from your transactions in the form of expense and what is the income that you file, that itself tells you something about potential tax evasion right there.
And how do you think, you as an academic-oriented person, do you think there is enough of a platform for academics to come and have a say in policy narratives or having ideation in terms of liaisoning with government agencies and policymakers? Or do you think there's way to go there as well in terms of, because it starts from policy making, right?
Yeah, so I am obviously biased. I would definitely want more engagement to the extent that it is possible. If nothing, just for feedback and back and forth with both policymakers, regulators, and government, right? And I think the government is already doing that. I know for the budget this year, they invited a host of academics and experts from all across the country, from IIMs, from ISB, from IITs. They did invite feedback. We are heading in that direction.
Yeah.
But in general, I do feel at the same time that both the government and the industry does fear, or maybe not fear, but do not value academic inputs as much as what you would see in the US.
Mm-hmm.
And that has to start with governments at least funding some institutes. So CAFRA and RBI, I thought, was a good experiment,
mm-hmm.
along the lines of FED. It's an independent research-driven institute under the aegis of RBI, but it's still a private body.
Right.
But with Raghu gone, with Viral gone, I don't know what will eventually end up happening with that particular institute. But some ideas along the line where you directly hire researchers to do this kind of work, that if you start building and investing in that capacity over time, it will benefit you. You can't expect these returns like any R&D investment. Cost are incurred first, the benefit will come 5 years, 10 years down the line. But at least the governments and bureaucrats and the industry has to be comfortable with sharing the data for these kinds of policy making. We have to move towards more data-driven policy making to begin with.
Yeah, that obviously makes a lot of sense. What's your take on the role of free markets or capital markets, just market participants, be it activist shareholders, be it short sellers, like in this entire, they're adjacent to this entire issue or there's always a lot of credit given to investors and traders for price discovery, for making the markets more efficient, and which translates into company's performance or the quality of management and governance. How important do you think market participants like traders and investors are to this entire equation?
And Shashwat, before you kind of answer that, you know, just to kind of add to Sharad's point, there's also the factor of, like, one is obviously the quality of disclosure, but the other is also the quantity or the granularity of disclosure, which I think plays a major role, right? In the sense that, why don't we see, I don't know, balance sheet disclosures at a quarterly or weekly, or at a quarterly or half yearly level? Or, you know, when you look at, like, say, a bank, and when you look at, say, and that's something I think Sharad Anuj had flagged, right? That if you look at, like, an NPA ratio of a bank, that's misleading if the bank has a fast-growing loan book, you know, because a lot of the NPAs are going to actually trickle down in the cycle later. So what's your take on that from a market standpoint? And lastly, obviously, like, we all know that in Indian markets, there's a fair bit of insider trading that goes on that probably makes the, you know, market participant intervention trickier than it is. What's your view on that?
So I think all of these issues are linked. Market, I personally do believe a lot in, I mean, markets self-regulating themselves. I'm a free markets guy to the extent possible. Obviously, there are market failures and we need governments to regulate whenever that happens. But if there was regular and granular information disclosure, then by and large, traders and market participants will take care about corporate governance on their own. So we as a team of faculty from ISB did meet our finance ministers Nirmala Sitharaman recently. And one of the proposals that I think I have taken some feedback from you guys as well was, so this, but this particular idea came from Prasanna, who is a faculty member here. What he specifically asked is that can banks disclose their NPA ratio, their ROA, their profitability on a weekly or bi-weekly or monthly basis? I mean, we have to think about the compliance cost as well, but as quickly as possible. At the same time, can they bunch a number? So there is privacy issues. We can't disclose how much a bank is lending to a particular corporate, but they can. We can classify distressed, non-distressed, potentially distressed industries and firms, group them together and look at the leverage ratios, how much is the bank lending to them, what part of the value is at risk. Again, on this disclosure on a weekly or bi-weekly basis would elevate the level of information content that is there for the market participants to play with. The other is, I think in general, the Indian governments tend to be, or regulators tend to be, very patronizing. The short selling is not allowed for stocks, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, if short selling is not allowed, this, the level of the amount of punishment that that markets can impose on stocks also is limited. So that all that happens now through the derivatives market. But if that were allowed, I think a lot of these issues would automatically get solved. But ultimately, I mean, the information content, the information environment of India has to go up, and I see that it's a positive trend, but we have a long way to go. So one small information or trend that you observe is the amount of investment in mutual funds, right?
Right.
Or equity markets in the past 4 years has grown exponentially. And this started happening in the US also around 95, so not too long back.
Right.
Yeah.
That gives me some confidence that markets or equity market participants are getting more comfortable with the quality of governance and disclosure environment in the firm. It's a positive trend, but there is some lack of trust. If we can build that trust, I think we'll see a lot more savings happening through equity, which is generally good for all economy. Why should we save in real estate or gold? These are unproductive investments.
Right. Well, I mean, we are kind of it's good to see a positive, conclusion to our conversation. What do you say, Sharad?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. This was time just flies when we talk about interesting stuff, right? I could go on, but no, this is obviously I'm an optimist, and I genuinely feel like, you know, like you said, like it started in 92. I mean, it's fair enough. Like, I mean, you know, we are 20, 25 years behind, and I think over the next 20 years, we will see a lot more robustness in capital markets, a lot more corporate governance issues being identified and addressed. So I'm positive, and I'm bullish over the long term anyway. So I've got nothing to complain about.
Yes. But like, on India, and we did criticize the corporates a lot. So because we started with COVID, let's get back to COVID maybe for a bit.
Yeah.
I think the corporates have played a huge role in India's resilience to COVID itself, right?
Yeah.
Maruti is working with one of the new startups which has come up with the low cost ventilators. Many Ambani, the Reliance has set up a new hospital in Mumbai. A lot of corporates have stepped up during COVID, not just in India, around the world.
Yeah.
Because in contrast with the financial crisis, where the corporates were the one causing the downfall, I think at this point, corporates are actually stepping up and helping economies revive, helping the healthcare system cope with the crisis. So, I mean, corporates are doing a great role, and I think they are very, very important to any economy and its growth. What we need is an environment where they can also be trusted by equity market participants, and we can reduce the conflicts of interest and corporate governance and ethics failures.
So we did talk about India's largest unicorn, Sharad, but in a different way today.
Yeah, we did. Shashwat, Anikhil and I have an inside joke. Every time RIL comes up, we call RIL India's largest and first unicorn.
It is, undoubtedly.
So, but I mean, you know, just kind of, you know, as long as like, I want to now ask Shashwat a bit about... you know, before we kind of sign off into, like, we spoke about governance, we spoke about corporates, you obviously named a few names in terms of, you know, their increasing role, especially during the COVID crisis, in terms of, you know, contributions, be it in cash, be it in kind, be it in healthcare support. But, you know, from a governance standpoint, if I were to ask you, which are some Indian companies that you really admire, you think who are, you know, kind of setting the stage for others, how would you respond to that?
From a corporate governance perspective.
This is suddenly the tone of the podcast became negative and cynical again. So.
No, I am a little, I'll tell you why, because this is obviously based on anecdotes, but yeah. I'm a little cagey about it. Satyam was winning corporate governance awards.
Right.
Infosys has the best corporate governance practices in India.
Sure.
And yet we saw this Vishal Sinha episode. We saw some conflict.
Come on, they got a complete clear, man. They are clear now.
So, but they still are rated very high on corporate governance. And they will even, maybe, because it's a relative number. But I think as a country, we have a far long way to go in terms of good quality corporate governance. Within India, obviously, there is variation. But we need to benchmark it with the best corporate governance country in the world. I mean, even US has a lot of failures. It's not like we had this WeWork fiasco recently, but we still have a long way to go. We have,
WeWork is interesting because I also take it as a case study for how markets actually corrected.
Right, within a span of weeks, it was came down from $45 to $12 billion to $800 million, and then they were filing bankruptcy. So I use that example in class now.
Right.
It's a good way to motivate a corporate governance class. But on admiring a company from a non-corporate governance perspective, I am very, very fascinated with Jio right now for a variety of reasons. This is one, as you said, the largest and the first ever unicorn in India, which is actually thinking about the future. And the future will belong to technology and data. And this massive investment by an Indian firm in data technology, in IT, through Jio, and the apps and the ecosystem that they are creating around it, they are working on AI, machine learning, etc. That, I think, is very, very promising. But ultimately, to have a say in the world, we need to have our own corporates that grow and dominate the world markets, like China has done. You have Alibaba, you have Alipay,
Tencent,
you have WeChat. A lot of Chinese companies are now competing with the best in the world. And so far, I see that vision in Jio. But I would hope that our pharma companies also start ramping up their R&D from being generic producers. This is the time for them, right? There is some concerns about China, who has been a global pharmaceutical supplier. We are a global supplier only in generics. But for that, you also need to bring in a culture of paying to attract the best talent. R&D is expensive, and equity investors in India are still a little bit cagey about long-term volatility. If you are an R&D company, you'll have to take volatility. And if you look at Jio, they are doing a lot of steps. They are reducing the debt, which is the first thing you should do when you are moving towards tech, because tech is going to be volatile. You won't have cash flows for a long time. So reducing your debt, and so I see this huge long-term plan of Jio, and I kind of like it. This, if you look at Jio in mirror, it seems like oil. The data is the new oil. I think that's an implicit signal. I like that idea a lot, creating this new stream of revenues through tech investments. And I think that would be, hopefully, that should pay up in the long run. There will be some risk and volatility for Reliance in the short run, but hopefully that is one thing that I admire about that particular firm.
Well, Jio has both data and oil, so that is exciting.
But they have been selling the stake in oil.
I kind of hear you completely on that. In terms of a vision, in terms of execution, they are a case study to watch out for sure. This was exciting. This was fun, Sharath. What do you think,
It was a lot of fun, and we've hit the 1 hour mark, so fascinating chat, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And Shashwat, thank you so much for your time, and it was a pleasure. And we took advantage of work from home and did it remotely, but we'll do this again once you're in Delhi again, I guess.
Sure. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you so much.
Subscribe to Transfin.
Absolutely. This is a great endorsement coming from Shashwat, and really, really appreciate that, man. And all right, guys, I think this is pretty much it, and we'll be soon back with another exciting guest on another work from home edition of Long Shots. So stay healthy and stay safe. This is Nikhil Arora, and I have with me Sharath Tupran signing off.